Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matthew Miller, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Joshua Scarf about his new book, Architectura, Architectural Ideas in Judaism and the Weekly Torah Portion, published by Orion Publications in 2023. Architectura is a collection of 178 short essays that investigate the Torah through the lens of architecture. Each essay briefly introduces a piece of architectural theory, a building, or a section of building code, and then re-examines a well-known topic in the Torah to uncover new and insightful interpretations. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I'm excited.
As am I. I wonder if you can begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Okay. Well, my name is Joshua Scarf. I was born in Toronto, and I moved to Southfield, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit, when I was 7. I attended Akiva Hebrew Day School, and now it's called Barber. And after high school, I came to Israel for 2 years, where I studied in Yeshivat Har Tzion. And then I returned to the States for college, where I was a student in the University of Michigan in the architecture school. I studied architecture there. At the time, I started working during the summers for Moshe Safdie and Associates. After I graduated, I moved to Israel, and I continued to work in the Safdie branch in Jerusalem. After about 5 years, when I got married, and I'm father of four, when my first son was born, I decided there's a difference between the architectural degrees in the States and in America, in the States and in Israel. So I had to go back and complete another architectural degree, a professional architecture degree in Israel. So I enrolled in Bezalel Academy of Art and Design. I was a student there, graduated, and I've been working as an architect in Jerusalem ever since. The firm that I currently work at focuses mostly on public buildings, which are like train stations, schools, hospitals, those types of things. And that's what I do day to day.
Sounds great. We didn't even talk about it at the beginning. I'm also Canadian, so the Canadian part is close to my heart as well. This podcast is about books, so we want to jump right into the book and discuss, why did you come to write this book? How did it come to be?
So when I was a student in college in University of Michigan, I was always intrigued when topics that we were discussing in architecture subjects, history or building, had parallels that I recognized from the Talmud. I learned pretty seriously while I was in college, and I had been doing Daf Yomi starting in high school already, and which is a daily study course where you learn a page of Talmud every day, and after 7.5 years you complete the whole Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. By the end of college, I was looking to do something that was more in depth, something that was more, as we would say in Hebrew, be'iyun. And so I thought it would be interesting to write about architecture in rabbinic literature. And from the start, I from what I could remember, I imagined it from the beginning as a book about the weekly Torah portion. So as a test, I went through the book of Genesis, and I started making a list of all the architectural topics that I could think of that I came across. And I saw that it was possible, so I got to work. Now, at the same time, I was also going through various corpus of Jewish studies. So I went through the Mishnah, the Tosefta, both of the Talmuds, books of Midrash Halacha, and Midrash Haggadah, and Maimonides' Mishnah Torah. And as I was doing this, I would index all of the different architectural discussions that came up. I wasn't the first person to do this. There was a famous scholar named Samuel Krauss who had done this about a century ago. But my goal is very different than his, and I had a much wider lens. So I was, at some point, I paired up the different subjects that I had indexed with the different ideas that I had come across in the Torah, and I sort of made myself a list of the topics that I could talk about for each Torah portion. And then over the course of what ended up being about 18 years, I started writing those essays and compiling it. I also, at the same time, was going through all the scholarly books and articles that I could find about architecture in the Roman and the Sasanian culture in late antiquity, and help using those discussions also to flesh out the topics that I come across in the Talmud. as well as lots of modern architectural theoretical books that deal with all sorts of different subjects. So it was a very interesting exploration for me, and I enjoyed researching it, and in the end, I ended up with the book.
That sounds good, and it's a really great book. I really did enjoy flipping through and reading and engaging with it. You mentioned Krauss as one of the scholars that had done some previous work on architecture and a connection to Jewish sources. What were the other scholars? What were the other works they were using that helped you complete and write the book that you put?
Okay, well, if we're talking specifically about scholars, Jewish scholars, people who are approaching this from Jewish studies, this is a Jewish studies podcast, most of the places that I found there are a number of books that deal with architecture either in the time of the Bible or in the time of the Talmud. So, for example, there are a number of books that were written. There's one book that was a compilation of different essays by famous archaeologists that dealt with the way architecture appears in the Bible, and talking about the archaeological finds that are there. There have also been a number of books that have just been written about the material culture in the time of the Talmud. So for example, let me think. Well, of course I used Vitruvius. He was kind of my guidepost. Vitruvius, the famous Roman architect who wrote 10 books on architecture. And when I was trying to decide whether or not a topic was sufficiently architectural to include in my book, I generally fell back on the idea that if Vitruvius talked about it, it was good enough for me. So, for example, you have material culture in the land of Israel during the Talmudic period, which was a book that was written by actually a pair of books that were written by Daniel Sperber. He also wrote The City in Roman Palestine, which focused on a number of specific topics in the Talmud. So that was probably the closest thing that existed to the book that I wrote. There was The Architecture of Ancient Israel from Prehistoric to the Persian Periods, which was edited by Aaron Kempinski and Ronnie Reich. Ronnie Reich also wrote the book on mikvaot, on ritual baths, which is another interesting area. There tended to be either broad surveys of architecture in the different time periods, or specific explorations of types of buildings. So you have there's one book that's written just about domestic architecture, about houses. There's one book that's written about bathhouses. There's another book that's written about aqueducts. And each one of these tended to include a chapter where either the author or a guest author would write about how that's presented in the rabbinic sources. So those I found to be tremendously useful in terms of the period of the Talmud.
I think I've been remiss, and we started off in some ways in the middle. How would we define architecture? What do we mean by architecture that we're discussing in this book and this interview?
You know, I guess this actually gets back to one of the earliest misconceptions that I have with this book, which is that most of the time when I tell people about the book, they say to me, "Oh, okay, well, if you're writing about architecture in the Torah, then you're of course writing about Noah's Ark, the Tower of Babel, and the Tabernacle, and that's about it, right?" And so I would have to explain to them that no, there's actually a lot of architecture. There's a lot of architecture that appears. So if you think about architecture, it really surrounds us, and we live in the built environment. Wherever we are, assuming we don't live in the forest somewhere, we are surrounded by architecture, and it affects everything that we do. So, for example, there are topics that might not come immediately to mind, such as accessibility, fire safety, egress, which is meaning being able to flee a building safely, all sorts of different techniques about construction, windows, doors. These are things that get mentioned in the background of a lot of the stories in the Torah, where you have the king noticing Isaac and Rebekah through a window, or you have a story of the people in Sodom the whole confrontation takes place near the front door of Lutz's house, and the door actually plays a major role in that story. So you could, if you understand how doors work, it actually deepens your understanding of what's going on at that moment. And that's true of many different stories that exist. Things like staircases or bathhouses. These are all things that appear in the Bible that aren't about architecture, but that an understanding of architecture could enrich your understanding of what's actually happening in the story. So to answer your question, I would say that architecture is actually a very broad subject. It's not just studying museums. It's not just thinking about castles and palaces. It's really all the small details and the big details. There are much larger things like the foundation of cities, where in Genesis it talks about the first people to build cities and what does it mean to have a city? How is that defined? And so I took an architect would tell you is that there's a ton of things that you need to know in order to practice architecture and to make good design. And I tried to bring in as many of those things as I could, both to give the reader a taste of what the field of architecture is all about, and also to bring that knowledge to bear on the stories in the Torah.
I was going to say, I think another good example that I saw in the book is the incident of Abraham greeting the three guests, three angels, three messengers that come to him. And you discuss the layout of a kitchen and how there's different layouts that are in modern kitchens in regards to where the oven is compared to where the sink is, all these different things, different layouts. Whereas in the time of Abraham, you got to run out to the well and get the animal, and things are very spaced out. So all this discussion of running and going and moving in that case is very understandable. And to contrast that to the way that we have kitchens now was very illuminating, something that I wouldn't think about. To piggyback off of that, if we're thinking about surprising finds, not that that was surprising per se, but things that you wouldn't necessarily think about, well, what are other examples, either specific examples or more broadly, that you came across as you were doing research that are surprising or interesting once you did the research and applied it to the text?
It's interesting to note that, of course, the Bible is one of the central texts of Western knowledge and scholarship. And so there were times that I found interesting sources that appeared in commentators such as Rashi or Ibn Ezra. There were other times that I found secular non-Jewish architects who were also discussing the verses in the context of their own designs. So you have, for example, whole conversations about what is the origin of architecture. And there was one scholar, a German scholar, who focused heavily on fabric partitions. And he said that this is the essence of what architecture is all about. And one of the things that he talked about was the fabric coverings of the tabernacle. And he talked about how that helped mark the space as being a religious space, a sacred space. Other times you have, there's a famous Jewish architect, Louis Kahn, who one of the things that he focused on most heavily was separating service and served spaces, meaning he thought that you should isolate the service spaces, ducts and closets and air conditioning, and make sure that that's all hidden so that when you come into a museum, you just see the space like a sacred space. And in one of my essays, I talk about how I discuss that in relationship to how the tabernacle was designed. And how in that case, the space itself was sacred. You didn't need to hide any of the service stuff because the space itself was sacred. That Kahn had to bring that in because he wanted to give his museums a certain sense, the same type of gravitas that they had in a religious space. And that I found to be a very interesting conversation and a very interesting way to look at his theory.
Yeah, it definitely is.
There are really many essays in the book that each of them is a unique topic, I invite your listeners to explore it. I think that they'll be very very richly rewarded.
I want to start from the beginning. If we look at the book, it's a very nice book, pretty heavy, so you can lift it as a weight if you don't have any weights. But of course, you should read it instead. Don't use it as a weight. But one of the things that I always like to talk about is the title and the cover image. So why this title? What does it mean to you? Were there other titles that you thought could have worked as well? And then also, what is the cover image and how was it decided upon?
Well, I love that you asked this question. Thank you very much for asking it, because the title, I can't exactly remember when the title came to me, but I knew that the instant that I thought of it, I was convinced that that was going to be, there was no question in my mind that that was going to be what it's called. It's called Architectura, which is a sort of pun. In Hebrew and in Latin, the word for architecture is architectura. And of course, here I'm just changing one letter to make it architectura, because it's a combination of studying architecture and Torah together. I was very, that was what I presented when I presented the book to the publisher. That was already my working title for the book, and they went along with it. And I think that's pretty self-explanatory. In terms of the cover, well, I told you already about how the natural inclination of people who I was telling the book about was to think that the book was going to be about the Ark, the Tower of Babel, and the Tabernacle. And so when it came time to design the cover, the cover designer and my editor wanted me to pick an image of one of those three major projects. And that was something that I pushed back hard against, because I thought it would only confirm what people were naturally going to assume about the book. And instead, I wanted to come up with something that showed one of the other dozens of small architectural points that come up in the Torah and in rabbinic literature. Now, at the same time, I was looking for examples of book covers that I liked. And I was reading a book called Building Construction Before Mechanization by a scholar named John Fitchin. And it had these amazing images taken from old architectural manuals which is a story in and of itself, but it also had one of those on its cover. And somewhere in the middle of that book, there was a footnote buried that mentioned groups of porters. And that's how I ended up finding the image that's on the cover. It has a picture of 32 porters who are transporting an obelisk. And this was actually originally an image in a book that was published by the Vatican about how St. Peter's Cathedral was renovated in the, I want to say the 1800s. But the image itself, actually, when I saw this image, my jaw dropped, because it exactly depicts a discussion that happens in the Talmud, in the Masechet Sota, which discusses how the 12 spies who were sent by Moses to the land of Israel to spy it out and found a cluster of grapes and carried it back. Now, the Torah itself says that it was carried by two people with a pole. And the Talmud asks why if it says two people, does it also need to say with a pole? Because that's redundant. By saying that it is being carried with a pole, we already know that two people are involved, and discusses the way that it was transported. And it comes up with this whole elaborate discussion about how it was carried using a group of eight porters who are sort of balancing the weight between them. And when I looked at this image, I realized that this was describing exactly what that rabbi from the second century had described as the way that the spies had carried it. And so I realized that there was no way that most people were going to get there's no way that most people were going to look at the image on the cover and immediately make that connection. That would be asking too much for my readers. But I thought it was architectural enough that it would be fitting for regular people. And for the few people who did make that connection, they would be enthralled and would instantly understand what the book was going to be about. And so that we ended up going with that image on the cover.
Beautiful. And you just mentioned regular people, so we can have a discussion about what exactly that means. But I want to drill into that a little bit and ask you, who is the audience of the book?
Okay, so it's interesting. So there's two distinct groups that I would say who might be interested in the book. I mean, I think that architecture itself has a vast appeal to a wide audience. There's so many people who I speak to who say that at one time they thought about being an architect, or they tell me how much they love to play with Lego. And we all live, like I said, in the built environment. But I think the book will appeal to people who are curious to learn about architecture, and also to people who are looking for a unique experience exploring the Torah. There's no special architectural knowledge necessary in order to understand it. I try to speak in layman's terms. I explain all the terminology. In the cases where I do use technical terms, I explain them in a very straightforward way. And I think that anybody will be able to enjoy it, even people who do not have an architectural background. In fact, of the reviews that the book has gotten so far, and thankfully most of them have been overwhelmingly positive, the book has yet to be reviewed by somebody who's actually an architect, at least not formally. And so I wonder how the book is going to play with people who are actually come from an architectural background, because I haven't gotten a formal review from somebody from that background. As a secondary audience, I think that the book will also be very useful for people who are researching architecture and are unfamiliar with rabbinic sources. One of the decisions that I made when I was doing the book was that I was going to use transliterations of the Hebrew name, so Avraham instead of Abraham. And I provide an index in the back that will help out anybody who isn't familiar with the Hebrew transliterations of the names. So that was definitely me coming from a perspective that I thought that the book would be more geared towards a Jewish readership, but it's certainly not limited to that. And I tried to make it as accessible as possible to all readers.
Yeah, I think that definitely shows, because I think things are explained very well, and I don't have an architectural background, and I'm able to read it very well and understand it. You mentioned that the reception has been positive overall. I'm curious, have there been any, I don't know, pushbacks, the right word, but any critiques, anything that you've heard that you thought made sense and that maybe you'll potentially update in future editions, or just were helpful feedback that gave you perspective that you didn't think about before you published it?
Well, the truth is that I haven't received any really negative feedback on it. I guess most of the people who speak to me about it are people who, you know, if they're thinking bad things about it, they don't want to tell me. But for the most part, I've gotten just a lot of positive feedback. I do sometimes think to myself whether or not I ought to have made it more scholarly. I think that I'm happy with how it turned out. And of course, as time goes on, and I by no means am stagnant in my studies, I come across other ideas which I think these would be great to have included. I do worry, of course, that there are mistakes. I imagine that every author has some fears, or if they don't, they should have some fears that there'll be mistakes in their book. But for the most part, other than a couple of typos that people have pointed out to me, I haven't gotten much criticism.
That's good. That's good to hear. The other thing I want to chat a little bit about is the subtitle and the structure of the book. So the subtitle is Architectural Ideas in Judaism and the Weekly Torah Portion. So the Weekly Torah Portion is the weekly reading that traditional Jews and synagogues read on the Sabbath and on Mondays and Thursdays, portion of that. The breakdown makes sense, but I'm wondering were there any challenges? So as you said, speaking about writing on the Tabernacle, pretty easy. Tower of Babel, pretty easy. Noah's Ark, easy to write about. But were there any portions, any sections that were more difficult to think of some architectural idea?
So the truth is absolutely there were. Like you said, there are some portions that are very rich in architectural ideas. There's certainly no shortage of discussions about the Tabernacle. And in fact, I didn't want to lean too heavily into that because it's been so covered so to such a great extent that, you know, there's no lack of discussions about the Tabernacle that are out there for anybody who's looking for them. Similarly, if there's one subject that's been covered about Jewish architecture, it's synagogues. So you don't have to talk too much about synagogues unless you're going to choose a specific aspect of it that relates to something else. I think that the decision to structure it as a parsha book, as a weekly Torah portion book, came from a couple of places. First of all, I thought that would be a good way to break it up into bite-sized parts that would be good for my readers to be able to handle small portions at a time. It also had to do with the way that I wrote it. I'm not a professor. I'm not a professional scholar. I'm an architect, and I work all day in an architecture firm, and then I come home and I, you know, take care of my kids, and then I try and make some time to uh, to do some writing. And so by breaking it up this way, it also made it a little bit easier on me that I could deal with one discrete topic at a time and keep the chapters relatively short. And that way it was a lot more manageable for me when I was writing the book. To answer your second question, it was definitely a challenge to find topics on each Torah portion. And I wanted there to be at least two for each section. I figured if people were going to buy the book, we should give them their money's worth. But in some of them, there are a lot more. I think that the most there are for any specific Torah portion is 8. And that has to do with how much architecture appears in each section. It was surprising to me that some Torah portions that you would not think of as being particularly rich in architecture end up having a lot of architectural discussions about them in ways that you wouldn't think. Bereshit, the first part of Genesis, which is very abstract in a lot of ways, but because of the way that people, that secular scholars have addressed Genesis and used it as part of their theory and their understanding of how the world was designed and God as an architect, there ends up being a lot of stuff to discuss in that portion, or in the portion that talks about Tzaraat, leprosy, which there is a type of leprosy that it's not exactly leprosy, but it's a type of the skin disease that afflicts people, and it also afflicts their houses. And it ends up that there, although you would not think that's a chapter that has a lot of architectural discussions, it turns out that there are. So if you look at my book and you see there are certain portions that have 5, 6, 7 topics on it, you'll know that I didn't have trouble finding ones for that, and I could be pretty selective. If you see one that only has 2 on it, then it's possible that I was trying to, that I needed to stretch things in order to get to those. And so there were some topics that could have gone into a number of different portions, depending, you know, that quote verses from different parts of the Torah. And so those, you know, I had to move some around in order to make sure that I had 2 for each topic. The beginning of Numbers, for example, does not have a lot going on. Some of the chapters at the end of the Torah, at the end of Deuteronomy, which are very short, also took a little bit of thought in terms of finding topics to discuss in them. But in the end, because architecture is so pervasive in our lives, there ended up being enough to find appropriate topics for every portion.
Yeah. So 8. There's a lot to digest. We've got 8 essays, so that's definitely a lot to share at the Sabbath table for those 8 essays. Even if there's just 2, I think there's still a lot there, a lot of meat and potatoes, even with those that have less essays. We've discussed, and you said at the top, that you're a professional architect. How have you brought these ideas that you've learned and that you've wrote about in this book to your architectural practice?
I'd love to tell you that that I have brought, that it's been very useful, but for the most part, I think that it's mostly a one-direction flow. Certainly, any amount of, as part of my research for the book, I've been reading many architectural texts, and those, of course, all get added to your general acumen as an architect. For the most part, I think that there's a picture of architects in like the Howard Roark picture as these, like, you know, creative geniuses who impose their vision on the world and can take, you know, a specific idea and run with it. I'm an architect. I work in an office. We do a lot of work for government agencies. There's some room for creativity, but for the most part, we're trying to make sure that our clients are satisfied and have the spaces that they need. So there's less bombastic symbolism and design gestures than you might imagine. So unfortunately, it has, and furthermore, I'm not the principal in my office. I'm not the one making the at the end of the day all the design decisions. So for the most part, it hasn't had so much of an impact on my day-to-day work.
When I'm hearing is not yet. So not yet.
Exactly.
The book is, it's almost 600 pages. So there's a lot of material that we could talk about. We could be here for hours, but for your sake, for the listener's sake, we'll make sure that we have just a more succinct conversation. Are there any specific messages that you want the book to convey that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Well, I think that one of the things that anybody who is reading this book will immediately realize is that architecture is all around us and affects the way that we live on a very deep level. And so I think that on one level, it will give people an appreciation of the work that architects do and all of the things that we take into account when we're doing design. And it will also, I think, deepen people's appreciation of architecture around them. When I walk through a city, I'm never bored because there's always buildings around me and I'm always looking at them and thinking about the decisions that were made. Today, actually, we're on a book podcast. Today, I went for the first time to the new National Library that opened up recently in Israel and Jerusalem, and I took the architectural tour. It was designed by a world-famous architecture office, Herzog & de Meuron, and it's a beautiful building. And I walked into the building, and it wasn't that the architecture took my breath away. It's that it felt like I had just received a gift. Me personally, I don't spend every day in the library. I go there on occasion to look things up and to spend, you know, some quiet hours doing research. It felt like I had received this gift, that this was something that I would personally benefit from. It felt like I was unwrapping a gift, and that there was now this new space in Jerusalem that I could use, that was something that was there for me. And that was an amazing feeling. And I think the architects did a great job at making the building welcoming and feel like a space that was shayach, that belonged to the citizens. And that's, you can't take that for granted. And it certainly was not the case in the former library, which was all the way in the back of the Hebrew University campus, that you needed to go through security and know exactly where you're going to get to, and kind of felt like a fortress and you have to go upstairs. Here, it really felt welcoming. And when you step into a building like that, you get an appreciation of what the architects do. And so I hope in some way my book also enhances the way that people will look at the world around them, and also help them appreciate these aspects, that these things that architects bring to their craft.
Beautiful. And speaking about gifts, this will make a great holiday gift for anyone who's looking. So go out and buy the book. I think one of the things
I originally pitched the book as something that you could buy for somebody as a Chanukah Tabayit, as a house when somebody's moving into a new house. It would be an appropriate gift. I don't know whether or not that had any influence on my publisher's decision to take on the project, but that was something that I thought about at first.
No, it's not like that. In order to get, so we've talked about different interpretations, different books. We've discussed a lot of things in the book. I wanted to maybe drill in a little bit more and just have a taste of some of an essay or two, just give some ideas from these Torah portions that we're reading currently in synagogue. We're reading now about Isaac and Jacob and their descendants. If anything that you could share, it could help us just have a better taste of what the book is trying to do.
Sure. So I'll give you one from each of this week's portion and next week's portion. And in the portion of Vayishlach, which we're reading this Sabbath, it talks about Jacob is approaching his return to the land of Canaan, and he gets word that his brother Esau is coming to confront him with 400 men. And so he famously prepares himself, according to the commentators, he prepares himself by three ways. He prepares himself by sending gifts, by praying, and by preparing himself militarily. And the way that he prepares himself militarily is by splitting his camp into two. He says in the verse, it says, if Esau comes to one camp and smites it, then the camp which is left shall escape. And the commentators discuss different ways that this might happen. Like if they're too busy killing the people in the first camp, they'll give time to the second people in the people in the second camp to escape. Or possibly if they're attacking the people, if they're killing the people in the first camp, then that will result in God taking mercy, having mercy on the people in the second camp and sparing them. This is something that I've been thinking about, unfortunately, in terms of what's been going on in Israel over the last 2 months, where we talk about the massacre by Hamas and how they, according to some accounts, they had much grander plans to either seize part of the land or continue on in their attack. but they were waylaid. They were too busy pillaging, and worse, that it gave time to the people of the communities and the forces of Israel to mobilize and come back and counterstrike, which is an awful way of thinking about the parsha, but unfortunately, it seems very relevant in today's current events. There's also in Genesis Rabbah, it talks about how this is a sign for future generations, where it was known that Israelites would be living in foreign lands, and they would have to take a defensive position, either by separate being in many different lands and always having a different place where they could go for a refuge, but also in terms of like how they would prepare themselves defensively. And I think about my grandfather who was born in Ukraine, and how their house, when there were pogroms, they had a hiding space under their floor, which they were able to go into with some of their neighbors and hide from the pogroms. And I think about how modern day architecture is in Israel has been affected by the same idea, both in terms of how the country has tried to spread out the population so that there it's not all concentrated on the coast near Tel Aviv, but also in terms of how after the Gulf War in the early 90s, they changed the law to require every house to have a safe room, which is designed to protect against missile strikes and against chemical weapons. Unfortunately, what it's not designed to protect against is people coming in from the outside. In fact, the opposite. They wanted to make sure the design code for the safe rooms is such that you always have to have at least two exits, because they worried that if a missile hits like the door of the safe room, they want to still be able to get the people out from the outside. And so if after the attack, the civil guard can come in and get the people out of the rooms via the window or via a trap door in the floor. And unfortunately, that worked against the people who were hiding in safe rooms in Gaza, because there is no mechanism for locking the doors from the inside, because they didn't want the doors to be able to be locked on the inside. They wanted people to be able to be rescued from the outside. And that's something that now architects are trying to come up with solutions for, how they could make it so that the safe rooms can be both safe from the inside and safe from the outside. So that's something that I've been thinking about, actually something that I wrote about a little bit, obviously, before, without the component about what's been going on recently in this week's Parsha. In terms of next week's Parsha, Parshat Vayishlach, so there's an interesting verse in the Torah in Genesis 39:12, where it says, where it's talking about Joseph and Potiphar's wife, and it says that she tried to seduce him, right? And she tried to lie. She says to him, "Lie with me," and he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. So the Jewish commentators ask why they often analyze when things seem to be redundant. So why does it have to say both "and he left" and "he went outside"? And one of the things that I talk about, I use this as a way of talking about the idea of egress. Now, when you're in a building that's on fire, it needs to be, you need to both flee from the fire, but you also need to get outside. And so that influences what the building code says about how you have to design the path to get out of a building. So for example, something you might not think about, something that if you're not an architect, you probably never thought about, you can't have a dead end corridor. So like if you're running down a hallway, right, and you see that there's a corridor over here, you don't want people turning down that corridor, getting to the end of it and realizing that it doesn't go anywhere. And then they've got to turn back around and go back in the opposite direction. And meanwhile, other people are going in that direction and you're trying to tell them. So you want to make it easy for people to both run away and to get outside. It's one thing to run away. It's another thing to be able to successfully escape the building. They're not really the same thing. And so that's my answer for why this verse is seemingly repeating itself in the language. And it's an interesting way to get people thinking a little bit about, again, another component that goes into the design of a building, making sure that the building is safe. And it's interesting, there actually is a midrash, a legend that talks about that the gates of the house were chained shut, and that Joseph had to break through the chains in order to be able to escape the house. And I think that gets at the same idea. And it also is reminiscent of how fire code developed in the first place. Incidents like in the Triangle Waste factory where the doors were chained shut. And so that led the local governments to pass laws about fire safety and making sure the buildings were safe so that people wouldn't all die in conflagrations.
And I think this and the conversation as a whole really brings out the point that this is a great book to better understand the Torah and its text. It helps give some more color and better understanding to it. And I think for me as well, as a layperson, a non-expert, helps me better understand architectural principles and see them from a Jewish light. So I think it's really, really a great read. At the end of interviews with New Books Network, we always like to ask a traditional closing question. What are you working on next?
As I've said, I'm an architect by profession. And so most of the things that I'm working on are elementary school, a train station, a health clinic, building projects. But in terms of writing, I do enjoy writing scholarly articles for journals. And after spending 18 years or so on this book, articles seem a little bit more manageable to me. But there are a few other long-term projects that I've got in mind. I've written a draft of a Hebrew-English architectural dictionary, which I think could be very helpful to all sorts of people. Maybe not the type of book that you that you generally talk about in this program, but that's one thing that I've worked on. There's an organization called Nefesh B'Nefesh, which helps Jews who are living in the diaspora move to Israel. And on occasion, I'm one of the contacts, one of the architectural contacts, who if somebody is an architect and they want to find out about the profession of architecture in Israel, people will get in touch with me. And one of the most valuable things that I could give them is a lexicon, because nobody learns how to speak. Nobody in day school learns how to speak about architecture. And there's just a certain vocabulary that you need to know, and there's nowhere to learn it. So that's one of the things I'm able to, that's the reason why I started working on that, so that I would have something to give people who are thinking of moving to Israel and don't have the language. Another project that I'm working on is, that came out of the book as well, is that there have been a number of source books about architecture in the ancient, in Latin and Greek works, where they extract the different references to architecture from that literature. And most of them exclude completely rabbinic literature as a potential source. So I would like to add to that scholarship by taking all the binders of notes that I have from writing my book and arranging the raw sources in a format that would give access to the scholars who might not be familiar with rabbinic literature. I think you could get a little bit of that out of this book, but if I formatted it differently, I think it could also be a valuable resource. And those are two of the ideas. There are a few others that I've been working on as well, but yeah.
It all sounds very interesting and very helpful for all sorts of people. So I appreciate all the work that you're doing for scholarship and for the Jewish people, and really keep up the great work. I really had a great time with this, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been great being here, and I really appreciate your podcast.
Thank you so much. We've been talking to Josh Scarf, author of Architectura, published by Urim Press in 2023. Happy reading, my friends.